The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello. Today on the program, it's a four-course literary feast. A note from a 17th century scientist on why we read literature. A conversation with an expert in the Russian Gothic. And the queen of black historical fiction chooses the last book she will ever read. Plus, Mike Palindrome tells us why he reads folktale theorist Vladimir Prop. That's all coming up today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jack Wilson at your service as your host and guide and general good-natured presider over accidents, as Orson Welles might say. We have an action-packed show today. We're going to start with a passage from none other than Galileo Galilei. Yeah, that guy, that astronomer and all-round giant of science who saw the craters and mountains on the moon and informed us of the phases of Venus and Jupiter's moons and gave us the pendulum clock. He was the first man to look out at the Milky Way and say, hey, this isn't just a general hazy light out there. That's thousands and thousands of stars. Imagine that, as he did first. And you might think that such a man who was in his laboratory and working with his telescope and performing calculations all day, you might think, well, who would have time for the arts with such a busy schedule? Or maybe it would be a general diversion for it. Maybe he had a friend or a neighbor or a loved one who dragged him kicking and screaming to a concert now and then, get him out of the house. And he said, hey, this is a distraction from my real work. Well, if you thought that, if that's your view of scientists, in this case, at least, you would be wrong. Galileo also gave us this beautiful description of art and the arts. And although it's in the mouth of a character in a dialogue, this is the intelligent layman in a dialogue between two philosophers and a layman. I'm going to go ahead and say that there's some of Galileo in here too. Let's hope so anyway. So here it is, quote, "And when I run over the many and marvelous inventions men have discovered in the arts as in letters, and then reflect upon my own knowledge, I count myself little better than miserable. I am so far from being able to promise myself, not indeed the finding out of anything new, but even the learning of what has already been discovered, that I feel stupid and confused and am goaded by despair. If I look at some excellent statue, I say within my heart, when will you be able to remove the excess from a block of marble and reveal so lovely a figure hidden therein? When will you know how to mix different colors and spread them over a canvas or a wall and represent all visible objects by their means, like a Michelangelo, a Raphael, or a Titian? Looking at what men have found out about arranging the musical intervals and forming precepts and rules in order to control them for the wonderful delight of the ear, when shall I be able to cease my amazement? What shall I say of so many and such diverse instruments? With what admiration the reading of excellent poets fills anyone who attentively studies the invention and interpretation of concepts? And what shall I say of architecture? What of the art of navigation? But surpassing all stupendous inventions, what sublimity of mind was his who dreamed of finding means to communicate his deepest thoughts to any other person, though distant by mighty intervals of place and time, of talking with those who are in India, of speaking to those who are not yet born and will not be born for 1,000 or 10,000 years, and with what facility, by the different arrangements of 20 characters upon a page." End quote. 20 characters on, that's the alphabet he's talking about. Okay, continuing the discussions now begun. He says, and here we are, 500 years later, or almost, continuing the discussion that Galileo began, not just the discussion of the stars in the distant skies, but the brightness and energy in all of us, those who arrange the characters on a page and those who read those characters, time travelers and stargazers, all of them, and all of us. Okay, first up today, or I guess second, if Galileo was first, let's bring out Mike Palindrome. As you may know, Mike and I have been urging books on one another for a few decades now. I still have a few copies of books that belong to Mike, with his marginalia, which are a delight. What the hell is going on? That one still cracks me up. Such a great way to read Shakespeare. In fact, now that I think of it, maybe I should call these segments with Mike, what the hell is going on with blank? Because there are a few books that Mike has urged on me that I've never gotten around to reading, or a few others that he's read a lot or more recently, or that I just want to hear what the hell Mike thinks is going on with these authors or books. So we're going to start a new little feature here at the History of Literature. We'll have a short segment where Mike tells us what the hell is going on with so-and-so. And when we talk, I set a timer. He gives me his take. And then we move on to the next one. Today, we're going to bring you a Russian folktale theorist, Vladimir Prop, who was born in St. Petersburg in 1895. He spent most of his adult life living in the Soviet Union, not exactly a great place for writers. We have an episode on Boris Pasternak in our archives. That's worth your time, I think, if you want to check that one out. But Vladimir Prop had a literary career nevertheless. He became an expert in Russian and German literature, and in particular, the Russian folktale, which he broke down into various elements. I've read about Prop quite a bit, but I've never actually read Vladimir Prop, and Mike has been telling me that I should. So I asked Mike what the hell was going on with the works of Vladimir Prop. Okay, Mike, so your first guy you chose was Vladimir Prop, who I know as kind of a Russian folktale guy, and you've been recommending him to me. I think you started in your mid-20s, maybe? I've never read what you recommended, but I remember you talking about this guy. You must have discovered him somewhere in your mid-20s, I'm guessing.
No, it was earlier. I was 20.
Oh, you were 20. Okay. So back in college.
Yeah. So he's a major 20th century Russian literary theorist, the Russian formalist. And remember we could take grad school classes as undergrads. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of undergrads showed up and we saw the reading list, which was like maybe two or three books a week. Mm-hmm. And the next class, there were only two of us left. Undergrad. So yeah, we had to read Prop. I mean, we didn't read every book in full, but big chunks of it, but Prop, we read the entire thing.
Mm. What book were you reading? The Morphology?
Yeah, I don't even know if there's any other books by him that, I mean, it was written in 1928, but only translated in 1958. The Brits and Americans were late to the game in discovering him.
Mm-hmm. So what did you get out of it?
I think it's such a funny, engaging book. It's a very, I wanted to read an excerpt. It reminds me of Dungeons and Dragons. So just to, if people are not familiar with it, he studied thousands of Russian folktales. Mm-hmm. And instead of classifying them by theme, which he thought, I think that was kind of the prevailing theory at the time, he divided it into character types, motifs, and plot points.
Mm. So themes would be, you'd say, this one is, these are about finding the gold, and these are about getting married, or these are about conquering a dragon, or something like that.
Right. So what he would do is he basically mapped all these folktales, and he would have these ways in which the folktales differed, but they were very much like, you know, choose your own adventure, could go this way or that way. Like, for mm-hmm. example, the hero and the villain join in direct combat. They either fight in an open field, engage in some kind of competition. They can play cards. And, you know, this is this is the way he breaks it
right,
out. And
and
it's pretty fascinating, the variety. Like another entry is, the hero is branded. A brand is applied to the body, or the hero receives a ring or a towel. He receives a towel like a couple of times. So it's just a really, it reminds me of Dungeons and Dragons. It's a really funny book.
Yeah. Right.
And I think it's, you know, I think it's very, very handy. Like when, raising my daughter, we were reading so many children's books, which I didn't really grow up reading children's books. Mm. And so I would start to notice, again, not really the theme, because the themes were all over the place, but the different character decisions. And so I pulled out my prop and I was making up stories and kind of using it as a guide.
Mm, right. You'd look at it and say, oh yeah, right. I can give this protagonist a magical power, or they can be given a special gift that gives them a magical power.
Right. And so it's never like this person was really lazy. It's like his brother attempts to deceive him because he's lazy. You know, there's always like, you know, it's very character driven. So it's perfect for kids.
Right. Because it has sort of a motivations that are kind of black and white, like like the Cinderella story. She's got stepsisters who are trying to keep her down, and she's got a Prince Charming who's needs to recognize her and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And like, messages, there's lots of letter writing and their messages conveyed, and like the message is delivered to an agent, and then there's this line, you know, this possibility, the agent carrying the message is drunk or is eaten.
And he like studied what he gathered hundreds of Russian folk tales.
Yeah, I guess it inspired a lot of people to go right to the source and see the variety and the, you know, the imagination of Russian folktales versus like German or, you know, English.
Mm-hmm.
And, I feel like it's very relevant today. You know, everyone says like we're in the golden age of TV shows and, like folktales are more akin to TV than movies because, you know, each episode has its twists, but then we return to like the baseline.
Yeah. Yeah. And there might be an overarching goal that someone has, like to be popular or to get the guy or to be happy in the marriage or something like that. But you get these episodic challenges along the way and obstacles to overcome and new skills to apply and that kind of thing. New characters are introduced to present difficulties and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I'm someone who makes fun of TV because it's so formulaic, but I think there is, sometimes I'm impressed by a TV show because even despite the formula, they come up with something original.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that, you know, Prop had a lot of fun in writing this book. Because there are great things like eating the message bearer, you know, and never getting the message.
Now you've already kind of you sort of answered a question I was saving for the end, which is why should I read Prop when I could just read a summary of him? You know, he identified 31 basic structural elements. I can read those on Wikipedia. But you've made it sound like if I read just a one sentence summary of each of the functions, I'll miss out on sort of the pleasures of the unusual details or the idiosyncrasies that come out of the folktales that he puts into the passage when he's describing the functions. So is that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the difference between reading a book review or summary of a book that has like, a handful of incredibly brilliant points versus really absorbing a book like this that has thousands of little
Right.
I mean, it's like reading Roland Barthes's SC, which is a critique of, I forget which French novel, but, you know, you could read him and get like the core principles of his that he believed in terms of like semiology and, you know, denotation, connotation. But when you read SZ, you really see how playful and how he came to his theories by way he reads. And I think this book is sort of a way to read Russian folktales without reading all of them.
Yeah. And maybe a way to read it with a kind of companion who's boiled things down and digested things in a way that would make it almost more interesting than reading the folktale itself by yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's also, for probably for a lot of readers, an interesting way to think of their childhood, the books they read. And because I think there's a, you know, society tends to clearly demarcate children's books with adult books. And I do think that there's a lot you learn as a child reading children's books that kind of lays the groundwork for the way you read as an adult.
Yeah. And then with something like Prop, you can look back and look back on your own childhood or look at your children and see what they're getting, and kind of, you kind of look under the hood of the stories they're taking in. Okay, we're getting toward the end of our, I've got a timer set here, but I know you wanted to read a passage, so why don't we hear that?
All right. Function number 18. The villain is defeated. Definition: victory. 1. The villain is beaten in open combat. 2. He is defeated in a contest. 3. He loses at cards. 4. He loses on being weighed. 5. He is killed without a preliminary fight, i.e. killed while asleep. He can hide in the hollow of a tree and he is killed. 6. He is banished directly. A princess possessed by the devil places a sacred image around her neck. The evil power flew away in a puff of smoke. Victory is also encouraged in a negative form. If two or three heroes have gone out to do battle, one of them hides while the other is victorious.
Okay, yeah, I see that. I see what you're talking about. What number was that?
That was 18.
18. And I'm looking at Wikipedia. The entry here is victory. The villain is defeated by the hero, killed in combat, outperformed in a contest, struck when vulnerable, banished, and so on. So I really don't get the same thing.
You don't get the hollow of the tree.
And right.
Being
you can
weighed.
Lose at cards.
there are a lot of Monty Python type moments where, right. You know, you wonder like, you know, oh, it just seems so random and hilarious in Monty Python, but that's what was in the folktale, you know,
right.
Magical potions and weighing each other. And
right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you're making the case for me. So what else do we have for Prop to sell Prop on people who are wondering whether they should read Morphology of the Tale?
It is such a light book. I started an Instagram about books that can fit in a pocket, and it's definitely a book you can fit in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. So not too many pages?
Not too many pages and small.
Yeah, right.
You know, compact. So and you can jump around. I guess that's another thing that's similar to other literary cultural criticism books I like Distinction by Bourdieu. You can just jump around from chapter to chapter.
Mm. Well, now I'm really excited about reading it, because one of the things that I love is stories and storytelling and narratives. And I love thinking about how they work and how they're put together. And, you know, it's always been the Joseph Campbell books and sort of analyzing Star Wars stories and other classical feeling stories in the context of something like Joseph Campbell. So it sounds like Prop is going to let me do something similar, where I'll read it and I'll think, oh yeah, that's an interesting, you know, sounds like they had interesting ways of solving that particular narrative problem.
Yeah, I think it'll kind of open your mind a little bit about the way some of your favorite children's book stories. You'll revisit those.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Vladimir Prop, Morphology of the Folktale. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, we turn now to a listener email to help us set up our main guest today. Subject, Gothic Tuberculosis, podcast idea. Dear Jack, there's nothing I love more than discussing books with like-minded, impassioned readers and listening to podcasts on authors and literary themes. Thank you for your wonderful podcast. It is most frequently enjoyed for me when I am out bush, alone for work, working in remote indigenous communities in Australia, or in the car, traveling to varying distances, also for work. I work in tuberculosis control in the Northern Territory, Australia. It might surprise you to hear that the landscape, energy, and spirit of remote, bushy Australia is undeniably Gothic. And I am frequently moved by and pulled towards pursuing Gothic literature when I am working in solitude and in seclusion. I would love it if you did an episode on either Gothic literature in general, Jane Austen, Oscar Wilde, etc. How do you even define or ascribe themes and plots as Gothic? What works, themes, authors, time periods can be awarded the pronouncement of being irrefutably Gothic, and why? Or tuberculosis. It took out many of the best. Jane Austen, John Keats, the Brontes, Camus. Cultural depictions of TB are endless. Moulin Rouge, Les Mis, Hunchback of Notre Dame. It features throughout many of Dostoevsky's works. Or an episode on both, how the two are indisputably, inextricably linked. I would love to know what you at least think of the idea for a podcast of this type. I understand if you think it ill-fitting for your platform and or audience. Alas, I may need to do my PhD. Every now and again, I am possessed by madness and think that I must. Many thanks and well wishes, Joanna. Well, Joanna, thank you for this delightful email and the stunning suggestion. And maybe you do need to do that PhD, Joanna. Tuberculosis. And you just gave us a partial list of those who fell to that disease. It truly is the awful disease that runs through literature, both in the pages and in the coughs and lungs of the people who wrote them. Combining tuberculosis with Gothic sounds like a worthy project to me. I hope you write it on a nice hot beach somewhere so you don't drive yourself mad or more mad with the gloom. As it happened, your email came in on a day when I was given the opportunity to talk to a guest who specializes in the Russian Gothic, and I said, yes, please. We haven't talked about Gothic in a while, and we've usually been in the world of Edgar Allan Poe or 18th and 19th century England, or maybe in the South, American South, with Flannery O'Connor and friends. But the Russian Gothic, I didn't know anything about that. Luckily, our guest is an expert and can fill us in. And the Gothic turn is not just about spooky night scenes with marooned travelers seeking refuge in some old castle. In this case, it's about the imperial uncanny, the anxieties about the Russian imperial and national identity that were present just as a Gothic wave from Europe came crashing onto Russian shores. Valeria Sobel is here to tell us more. Okay, joining me now is Valeria Sobel, who is professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's here today to discuss her book, Haunted Empire, Gothic and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. Valeria Sobel, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you, and thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with your background. When did you first become interested in Russian literature?
I grew up in Ukraine, which was then the part of the Soviet Union. So I grew up in Kyiv, the capital, but as you may know now, it was kind of dominated by Russian culture. And so I did become fluent in Ukrainian eventually and discovered Ukrainian literature kind of in high school and college. But as a child, I was mostly exposed to Russian language culture. And I was an avid reader, a precocious reader. My parents claim I started reading at the age of three. I think it's a family legend. I don't think I was that smart or amazing, but I was pretty early and I just devoured books in Russian. They could be translations of Western works. I actually was obsessed with Alexander Dumas' historical novels in Russian, something similar to like Harry Potter. It was this, for my kids, it was the same level of obsession, but also Russian classics. Yeah, I really always enjoyed reading, especially 19th century Russian literature and French literature, and I continued working on the 19th century as well. I think I'm a bit of a romantic myself, and I like this distance from the present. And then I went to school. It was also very kind of promoting Russian literature heavily. It was a natural habitat for me as a child, as an adolescent, and I just continued with it. But then developed kind of a secondary specialization in Ukrainian literature and was always interested in connections with the West.
Right. So now this question might be hard for you to untangle, but I'm curious about when you discovered Gothic literature. And I don't know if there was a moment when you realized that Gothic literature was kind of a subcategory, or if it all just kind of blended together with the types of romantic works that you were reading from the 19th century.
Great question. So some colleagues I know who work on the Gothic, they were sort of readers specifically of the Gothic genre and then became academically interested. No, for me, it was the other way around, I think. On the one hand, it was part of organic part, right, of the romantic works. So I was aware as a student of literature and then a scholar of literature, I was aware of that this genre existed. But I became interested in it after I kind of conceived of this project, which originally did not have a Gothic component in it. I was thinking more about inter-ethnic, intercultural encounters and how they're portrayed in literature in the imperial context. I was also interested in, maybe because of my background as a Ukrainian Jew, you know, in the Russian, in this like Russian environment, I was drawn to questions of the empire. But it all started, we'll say, with me teaching a course in Russian travel literature, which was more along the line, right, of those ethnographic various description and encounters between different populations, right, of the empire. And I started noticing that there is some kind of dark, unsettling atmosphere surrounding those encounters. And that kind of led me to this exploration of the connection between the imperial context of these encounters and the Gothic literary legacy.
Right. Okay. So to locate our setting for people, this is the 1790s to 1820s, and we're basically in Europe, but I don't know which country it began in, if Britain gets to make that claim, but it traveled throughout Europe. How should we describe Gothic for people?
First Gothic novel, often singled out, The Castle of Otranto from the 1760s. One can talk about the Gothic genre in a very strict sense as a Gothic novel, right, with a particular characteristics. And I like to talk more about the Gothic mode as a more flexible category that allows me to look at some other narratives that don't necessarily fit the strict category of the Gothic novel as it developed in England, but also have this Gothic tropes that invoke certain themes that are very important for the genre and for my research. But to give you just a classical definition or list of characteristics, so typical Gothic novels would have, it's a very formulaic genre, actually. There's typically a dark sort of suspenseful atmosphere. Reader is led through some sort of moments of fear, right, and anxiety. There is often a predictable required almost setting, like a castle, right, or an abbey, or in a cemetery, or a dungeon, or at least part of the work taking place in those settings, which of course is a problem for Russia, which did not have many castles. And that's why I'm more comfortable with the Gothic mode, the more flexible, broader definition, but sometimes just an ancestral home can serve as a kind of stand-in for the Gothic. Yeah. As long as it invokes certain themes of transgression or the history, the past haunting the present, or some kind of trauma hiding behind the walls in the dungeons of that place. So there's often an exotic setting. And for British Gothic, it was Southern Europe, usually Spain, Italy, Southern France. And a choice had to do with the idea that somehow when these novels, as you said, appear in the late 18th century, and British culture kind of positions itself as this kind of rational, enlightened northern civilization.
Right. So from the British point of view, it would be down there in those countries, there are some dark elements of individuals, monks or priests or wealthy aristocrats who have these really dark secrets in their past, and they're living in these places. And if you accidentally, like, let's say you're caught in a thunderstorm and you knock on the door and it creaks open, you don't know what it is that you're getting yourself into.
Exactly. Perfect description. Yeah. So, and speaking of aristocrats, so often the kind of the villain figure, the stock character of a Gothic novel and its later variations, is that sort of male villain figure with sparkly, glistening eyes and some potential demonic, you know, characteristics. Often he has an innocent maiden whom he tortures or somehow confines. He has it, his power is for a ward or an orphan. So there's a kind of gender dimension, which I don't dwell on too much in my work. And then, of course, the emphasis on irrationality, on some transgression, to the extent that incest becomes a common theme, or at least quasi-incest. There could be like a brother and sister that are feeling some attraction for each other, but they don't understand why. Sometimes it gets really ugly, like in Matthew Lewis's novel, The Monk. But in one Russian text I look at, for example, the husband, the German baron, is extremely jealous of his Slavic, like Russian, his Slavic captive, because his wife and this captive have some clear attraction for each other. But later it turned out to be that they're actual brothers and sisters, but there's actually no romantic interest there. The novella doesn't pursue that, but I still see it as part of this Gothic mode, right? There's still that incestual possibility that's explored, or in this case, actually, maybe a confusion of categories, which is more important for my emphasis on the uncanny.
Yeah, let's turn to that now, because I want to merge this with your interest that you described at the beginning of Russian travel stories and Russian encounters, I guess, in unknown lands and so on. So what was actually going on with these anxieties about the Russian imperial and national identities? And then let's talk about what was going on kind of in the world first, and then we'll talk about how that began to play out in fiction.
So it's always a bit dangerous to draw direct connections, right, between literature and political and historical events, because it's a more complex relationship. But there's a kind of consensus that, for example, the British Gothic in its sort of most influential form developed as a response to the French Revolution, and not direct response, but in its aftermath, right, the sense of the world collapsing, right, as we know it, the cruelty, the terror, right, Napoleonic Wars, everything that followed basically signaled the crisis of enlightenment and ideals, and suddenly Gothic, with its emphasis on the sometimes supernatural, sometimes just falsely supernatural, but the irrational, right, the suppressed, blurring of categories, this sort of seen as the response to the more general sort of historical crisis. In Russia, it develops both at the same time and later, the most classical and earliest Gothic novella I could mention is Karamzin's The Island of Bornholm that I discuss in my first chapter. It's 1793, so it's right at the time. And Karamzin was actually in France during the French Revolution, but it's not about that directly. He is also a future historian of Russia. He wrote multi-volume History of the Russian State. So I think he's concerned as much, influenced probably by his experience as a traveler during the French Revolution to Europe, but also by his kind of anxiety about Russia's origins, because the novella is about the traveler stopping on a Danish island of Bornholm on the way from, during this sea trip from England to St. Petersburg. And there is this like attributes, part of the Gothic novella, the mysterious owner of the castle, some mystery. There's a woman in the dungeon that he discovers, and later it's clear that she had some transgressive relationship with a young man he had seen early in Denmark. But the interesting thing is all this is interrupted by this kind of lecture on history. The old man, the owner of the castle, says like, oh, do you know, you're Russian, how great Slavs used to live on this island, because it's one of those islands in the Baltic Sea, which indeed have some Slavic population, but it's a property of Denmark. They immersed in this darkness of paganism here and so on. And the theme continues and becomes clear that the darkness of the island, this story of this potential incest and the transgression and the mysterious woman somehow is entwined with this anxiety about the origins of Russian history, right? Like, this could be us. We could be those Slavs who just remained unenlightened and dark, right? And so on. And of course, given that Russia often traces its origin to Scandinavia, right? To this kind of Vikings whom they invited to rule over them, there is even more overlapping of this Gothic and historical plot. So I think that the crisis of the world and the anxiety about Russian origins and its belonging and this whole course grand picture of Western history is one of them. So it's not necessarily one specific event, but this was a time when Russia was sort of coming out of obscurity, emerging as a powerful empire, maybe a nation. So overall, I would say the anxieties are, you have a huge country that recently, early 18th century, right, became or tried to become a modern empire as a result of the Westernization, right, Peter the Great's reforms, emerging from obscurity and kind of desperately looking for both its belonging as a part of Western civilization, but also with the rise of Romantic nationalists trying to pinpoint its national identity. So as it's catching up with the West and borrowing Western right practices, even language, right? We all know that Russian elite spoke French. At the same time, it develops acute anxiety about Russian authentic culture and what to do with it, right? Given that kind of Westernization project. And they often actually looked at Ukraine as a repository of like true pure Slavdom that Russia as a whole has lost as a result of Westernization. So you have this huge complex inferiority with the West. At the same time, you're an empire that's expanding. Empires should not have an inferiority complex, right? They should perceive themselves as, you know, civilizationally superior, as expanding on the premise of the Enlightenment project, right? Even though it's a false premise. But then they get territories like Finland that was part of Sweden, or Ukraine that was part of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth that often we're more educated, let's put it this way, and at some level more westernized than the core Russian population. So I wouldn't say specific developments in the world politically, but more like the general trends, right? The development of Romantic nationalism, the Russian cultural dependence on the West, the kind of uncertainty about where Russia actually belongs and what its borders are as it's continuously and contiguously expanding. This created an acute, I think, sense of kind of disorientation and confusion. And then you have the Ukrainian writers, whom I also explore in my book, who joined the Russian imperial project. But at the same time, they were painfully split precisely because of that strong ideals of Romantic nationalism about, but what do we do about the Ukrainian authentic culture, which we admire, which was so unique and rich, and we're kind of losing it. And I argue that the Gothic tropes proved really handy by the virtue of them constantly playing with the past that comes back and haunts the present, right? So that like history is something that recedes, but never fully, right?
Right. Your example of what was going on in response to the French Revolution really helps me to understand what you're talking about with these in these Russian books, because you can see what a convenient vehicle it is for an author who's interested in exploring these things, whether consciously or to some extent unconsciously, to say, you know, this is going to be the classic stranger goes on a journey and encounters something, but then the stranger, you know, or a person, I should say, goes on a journey And then that person learns more about himself or herself and about the land that they came from by encountering what they encounter in this new and unknown land. And to the extent that they see something different or they see how they are recognized and treated by the people that they are staying with or that they encounter along the way can help them kind of put into the mind of the protagonist the kinds of themes that someone who is anxious about national identity or about, you know, where do we fit in the world? Who are we exactly? And how does the world see us? And is that the same as how we see ourselves? It seems like this perfect way of kind of smuggling all of that in to what is essentially a thriller story or something that's designed to keep people turning the pages because they want to find out if the person is going to escape and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and I want to hear about more specific examples of the authors you were looking at. Okay, we are back. So Valeria, we've talked about some bigger themes, and you mentioned Karamzin. Which other authors do you cover in your book? And do you go throughout the 19th century, or do we see this in a very particular time period?
Yeah, so I sort of focused on the 19th century, kind of roughly the Romantic era. I talk a lot about less known, actually, writers outside of the canon, both as it's formed in Russia itself and the West. I talk about Pogorelsky, who was a very influential at the time, very popular romantic writer of the 1820s and can be seen as a precursor of Gogol. I talk about Gogol very briefly because his Ukrainian themes and his problematic identity is explored great length by other scholars. I talk about Vladimir Adoevsky, who was actually a very interesting figure, I think grossly underappreciated both in Russia and in the West, an interesting romantic writer. And then I talk about a Ukrainian writer, Pantelimon Kulish, and I discuss his attempt to be a Ukrainian Walter Scott. He was directly labeled this way by his contemporaries in his early novel, which kind of seems to follow Walter Scott's narrative, but also has strong Gothic component and how he settles scores exactly with this Ukraine's loss of its authenticity as a result of full integration into the Russian imperial structure. But the travel course that triggered my whole interest in the topic, and I opened my book with this example, Mikhail Lermontov's novel, A Hero of Our Time, rotates around a Byronic, romantic, disillusioned, kind of ruthless hero who is disillusioned with his life in Russia, you know, in St. Petersburg, and comes to the Caucasus to take part in the war, but also to kind of look this typical romantic search for exotic setting, for novelty, for adventure, for some titillating experience. But he can never quite find peace of mind and eventually dies before coming back to Russia. So the novel consists of several novellas. Actually, it's not a conventional novel, but united by this protagonist, and it's out of chronology. But the central novella, which is chronologically the first, is called Tamany. And it was kind of a Cossack settlement at the time. And our hero, he's traveling from St. Petersburg to the Caucasus to the war. He stops there. And his adventures in this town are related in this novella. And this, I think, is a perfect example of how Gothic elements work to create this, both the uncanny atmosphere and to kind of introduce the question of the empire and identity into play. There is a kind of this uncertainty and playfulness of identities, even of physical disabilities. We have a dark atmosphere. We have a kind of subhuman, strange characters. But their strangeness comes from their ethnic and anthropological indeterminacy. And all this unfolds at the frontier in a small Russian town that the protagonist directly labels as refers to dismissively, like little godforsaken, horrible little town in Russia, probably the worst ever. And this is where the protagonist faces the greatest danger, not in the Caucasus, not when he goes later to the war. And that's where I ask the question that these imperial borderlands are scarier, are more uncanny, right? Are more threatening then a completely exotic, different land, at least in the Russian context. This is true because he's still in Russia, but he doesn't feel at home. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't have control of the situation. All the categories, right, the imperial categories of ethnicity, language, all divisions are blurred. And I think this unsettling effect of those borderlands that are houses created through the literary Gothic tropes precisely work to raise these questions about what I'm doing here. Where is the Russian Empire? What does it mean? Who am I, right?
Right, right.
What is Russian? What is not Russian? So that's how this whole project kind of started. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it seems like they'd be saying you can be comfortable in Moscow and you can be comfortable in Paris, which is completely different. But where you'll be uncomfortable is where you get into these border areas where the people are Russian, but not Russian. They're sort of
exactly
they're similar, but there's enough difference that it makes you question who exactly you are and all of the foundation that you've had for why you think the way you do about who you are.
Wonderful. You summarized it better than I did. But that's exactly what it is. And that's why I found Freud's concept of uncanny, right? Unheimlich.
Yeah.
It's also not quite homey.
Right, right.
The boundaries between the familiar and unfamiliar, the one's own and other, right? The home and the strange land are in the concept of uncanny. They're questioned and blurred. And this worked so well for this project.
Do you think these writers had an agenda that they were trying to push to sort of say, so we need to retreat and stop expansion, or so we need to expand in a more dramatic way and kind of impose ourselves on these borderlands? Mm-hmm. Or do you think they were just observing what they observed and expressing anxiety because that's the way they felt when they went to these places?
It varies a lot. It depends on the specific author. In some cases, I think it may be just really, I hate to say unconscious, but I think it's unconscious kind of way of figuring out some of the Ukrainian writers, right? Like what they do with that split, right, between being part of the Russian imperial project and trying to recreate some or preserve or revive Ukrainian national culture. Although one of them at least was semi-involved in a specific political activity, Kulish, who was actually arrested and exiled for his association with the Panslavist sort of socialist Christian group in Kiev, St. Cyril and Methodius Brotherhood. That's not exactly what his novel is about, but you can see some of the same concerns. But for some of them, it was more, I think, was less specific. For the Decembrists, for the Russian actual progressive writers whom I look at in my Baltic chapter, future political activists were still very much kind of enslaved to the imperial priorities and agendas. We're writing about the Caucasus, we're writing about other territories. So one of them, at least, Bestuzhev, portrays a Baltic region. Historically, it's set mostly before it became part of Russia, but it portrays them as kind of still a part of the Teutonic, you know, Livonian order, ruled by those evil, demonic, tyrannical German barons. And there's always some kind of Slavic character that sneaks in and that somehow belongs there and kind of questions that whole, you know, injustice of the rule. But they're all doing this while those territories had just become to Russia's possession as a result of the war with Sweden. And there was a huge obsession with the Livonia, as they call it, the side of medieval culture and architecture and history that Russia itself didn't have because it was, you know, cut off from the West by the Tartar-Mongol yoke. So they all travel there, they'll explore it, they use it in their settings. But in the meantime, they also kind of sneak in this agenda that, yeah, it's really good that we liberated them from this yoke of history of this dark, evil, cruel, Gothic German barons. At the same time, the stories were very popular because they fed this sort of imagination, fascination with the exotic medieval Baltic world.
And maybe for literary historians, the question is not so much, did they have an agenda? But it's just as interesting to say, well, they were looking around for a scary situation, and this is what they found, and this is what they thought would help to put this their reading audience into this mood. And isn't it interesting that this is what they settled upon in order to create this kind of mysterious and as you say, uncanny world? They could have gone to South America, or they could have, you know, done something else, and instead this is where they chose to set these settings. It really is a fascinating topic, and I think we should probably leave things there. The book is called Haunted Empire, Gothic and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. Valeria Sobel, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And finally today, we turn to our friend and previous guest, Vanessa Riley, a.k.a. the Queen of Black Historical Fiction. She was here to tell us all about her novel set in the wake of the Haitian Revolution. After we talked about her work bringing the unforgettable Marie-Louise Christophe to the page, I asked Vanessa this special question. Okay, we're here with the Queen of Black Historical Fiction, Vanessa Riley, author of The Queen of Exiles and many other novels. Vanessa, this question comes from a listener, and I'm going to warn the listeners that usually the people I ask this question of have some advance notice, but this is coming to you as a surprise. So
I'm holding on to my seat.
This question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
The last book that I will ever read has to be something long, like War and Peace. So it takes a while.
Stretch it out. Yep.
Stretch it out. I don't know. I clap on that. That's a great question. I would have to have some adventure. It definitely has to have some romance or love story involved in it, because I like all the engine firing on this book.
I
want it to be a quest of some sort of quest, something unimaginable, and I want there to be a cast of characters that are diverse, and they come together because they all want this quest, different meanings of why they want it, but they all want, that's the unifying thing, they all want this quest. That would be mine for that.
This sounds like one of those great novels in the 19th century style, where there was a lot of room to bring people on and off the stage, and it's maybe 800 or 900 pages long.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, a lot of people might look for that and turn to the works of Vanessa Riley.
I hope so. They're not 800 pages long. They are long, some of them.
Well, we could have cheated and said the collected works of Vanessa Riley. Maybe that'll
there
be
we
it.
Go. There we go. That definitely will hit 2 or 3 of them will hit 800. There you go.
Okay, Vanessa Riley, thank you for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you for having me. Have me back sometime.
Okay, there we go. That's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. My thanks to Mike for telling us all about Vladimir Prop. To Vanessa Riley for that cameo appearance. Have me back sometime, she said. I would love to. Vanessa, next book. Let us know when that one's ready. We will definitely have you back. To our listener, my thanks also to our listener, Joanna, for her work on tuberculosis and her wonderful email to us. And of course, to Valeria Sobel, whose work, Haunted Empire, is highly recommended. And be sure to check out Vanessa's books as well, including Island Queen and Queen of Exiles. She is a novelist who delivers the goods. Speaking of which, we have more goods to deliver soon. How about Samuel Taylor Coleridge? You didn't think we'd stop with Wordsworth, did you? Those two are like bookends on a nice end table with good poetry and essays lined up between them. I've got some Machiavelli on my mind and some Knausgaard on my knee. And some, who's next? Dr. Johnson. Oh boy. Well, we better quit while we're ahead. I will stop there. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.